This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott today. I want you to picture the number five, a big number five. Now, I want you to imagine it's alive. Is it a man or a woman? How would you describe five's personality? Is he or she a casual, laid-back number, or maybe a more serious, even unhappy kind of digit? Or if you met five at a party, do you think you'd get along? As strange as this exercise may seem, humans have long saddled numbers with gender, identities, mystical or religious symbolism, with superstition, and even with personality traits. Author Alex Belos explores that emotional relationship and much, much more in his new book, The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. Alex, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So you write that the first recorded evidence of numeric symbols show that we were already sort of giving them human characteristics. How so?
That's correct. So the first time we developed symbols and words for numbers was about 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, or Sumer, which is where Iraq is now. And the very first words that were used for one and two are the same words used for man and woman. So right from the beginning, there's this identification of odd numbers with male characteristics and two with woman and female characteristics. And you see this also very strongly in the beginning of mathematics, as we know it, say the ancient Greeks, and Pythagoras, who is kind of the leader of this kind of cult that had really interesting metaphysical views about number. And one of their strong views was that odd numbers were masculine and even numbers were feminine. And they actually kind of justified their rather sexist worldview using that, because they said, look, if you take an odd number and you add it to an even number, say 3 and 2, you get 5, which is an odd number. So odd plus even is always odd, which somehow symbolizes the fact that odds are dominant over evens, and therefore how man is dominant over women. So what interests me as a mathematician is how numerical properties somehow influence our emotional understanding and our psychological responses to numbers. You know, lots of people could have different favorite numbers or think that numbers mean different things, and those are all going to be very sort of personal. But I was interested more, is there any kind of collective way that humans in general interpret numbers, respond to them, because of their numerical characteristics?
Right. Well, it seems like we have something of a schizophrenic relationship with some numbers. You know, I'm thinking about some prominent numbers in superstition, in even the arts. 7 and 13 are both examples I think of that can be, depending on how you look at them, maybe ominous, unlucky, or very lucky numbers, favorable numbers.
Yeah, I think that when I started to look at how we respond to numbers, it was pretty clear very early on that the numbers that have most mystical and mythical associations are the low, odd, and prime numbers. So prime numbers are the numbers like 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, which only divide by themselves in 1. And I thought, well, isn't this odd? You know, you go to the most ancient myths, and it's, you know, 7 brides for 7 brothers, 7, you know, halls in heaven, all the different religions all over the world really focus on specific numbers, 7 in particular. 13 is something much more recent and is only in the kind of Western tradition. Mm. And 13 is essentially unlucky. 7 is the one that's lucky. And to me, it's not a coincidence that people have chosen to invest more mysticism in indivisible numbers. And when I looked in to see if there are any psychological reasons, you can actually discover that there are some interesting psychological experiments that maybe explain a little bit about why this is the case.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading your book, they're rare. Prime numbers, the higher you get, the harder they are to find. And there's something always about something rare that we're very attracted to.
Well, these are the high prime numbers, but most people can't tell you whether 101 is prime or not. It's
right.
Too complicated unless they've been told. Whereas people subconsciously know that 7 is prime. The classic sort of experiment that will reveal that, really, is just, I would say to you or to anyone, this is an experiment that lots of people have done in psychology departments. Think of a number from the top of your head between 1 and 10. Most people will think of a 7. Now, why are they doing that? They're doing that because thinking of, the first number that comes to the top of your head between 1 and 10, you wouldn't choose 1 because that just seems kind of boring. Or you wouldn't choose 10 because that doesn't seem arbitrary or random enough. And also you wouldn't choose 5, it's exactly halfway. So there's this idea that actually what you've just done there is like the 5 and the 2 times table. You eliminate all the numbers that you can either multiply to get there or to divide to get there, and the only one that's left is the number 7, because the number 7 is numerically unique among the first 10 numbers, because it's the only one that you cannot multiply any of the others or divide any of the others within the group to get it. And I think that we just instinctively understand that. We understand that 7, it's a bit more complicated. We need to think about it for a little bit longer. It doesn't really fit in. And that, to me, is the only plausible reason why 7 is so redolent with mysticism and has been amongst all cultures through all time.
I'm speaking with Alex Bellos, the author of The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. And we're talking about the personality, the gender, the suspicions behind numbers, the way we give numbers human characteristics. So you and I have something in common. Neither of us have a favorite number. I don't know why, but it's never occurred to me to have one. But you did a pretty big internet survey, and you found out that lots of people have favorite numbers and reasons for having favorite numbers. Tell us a little bit about what you discovered in that process.
Yeah, well, this is the great love that dare not speak its name, the love that people have for numbers. So as you say, I don't really have a favorite number. But as a math popularizer, I would go and give talks. At the end of the talks, people would always ask me to, you know, any questions I would say, and they'd say, yeah, what's your favorite number? And this would just infuriate me because I thought they were demeaning me. They were kind of just trivializing what I was talking about. Yeah. Until I then asked the question back, and I said, well, what's your favorite number? And then I would get I got a very kind of rational, considered response, you know, 12. And they had, really? You've got a favorite number? And there was a kind of murmuring from the audience. And I said, well, who here? Seriously, you know, you're all grown-ups, has a favorite number. And more than half the audience put their hand up. And I thought, oh my God, this is now really interesting. So I, you know, with the internet, making, you know, internet surveys are quite easy things to set up. I thought, is there a way that I can try and quantify this emotional responses to numbers and what people's favorite numbers are? Are there any, you know, overall themes? So I set up this website. It was on favoritenumber.net. And now if you go to favoritenumber.net, it has all the results. And I was just amazed at the interest that it caused.
So what exactly did you find out?
There are general collective opinions that we tend to have about numbers. So firstly, we tend to like or find as favorites odd numbers better than even numbers. And the ones that we like the least are round numbers. So 10, no one really likes 10. Whereas 7 feels much more interesting. Obviously, 7 won with about 10%. And I also quantified all the reasons that people gave. And so the most popular reason for giving a favorite number, I was born on that day, therefore it's my favorite number.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, if you were born on the 7th or, say, the 13th, you're very likely to choose the 7 or 13 as your favorite number. But if you're born on the 25th or the 30th, you're very unlikely to choose it as your favorite number. So it's not just that dates are important to people. It's dates with certain numbers feel more resonant than other numbers. I mean, one of the reasons why I don't really have a favorite number is I was born on the 22nd, which is not a particularly, yeah, I guess it's got two twos, but it's not a particularly memorable number in the way that 3, 7, or 13 is. I don't know, what day were you born on? Maybe that explains why you don't have a favorite number.
Yeah, the 26th.
Well, exactly, 26th. No one really chooses that
yeah.
as their favorite number.
One of the things that I loved about your survey is that you not only discovered people's favorite numbers, but also that people give, you know, very, very human qualities to these numbers. For example, I think, one, you have qualities like independent, strong, honest, brave, straightforward.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So what I did is that I went and I took the adjectives used to describe the number, different numbers, and just put them together. So words that people use to describe number one, independent, strong, brave, pioneering, lonely, are all actually quite masculine qualities, which ties into what we were saying just before, that this connection between gender and numbers. Two, cautious, wise, pretty, fragile, sympathetic, quiet, flexible. Again, quite feminine adjectives. And it's funny because when I had my launch in London, and a friend of mine who's quite a well-known novelist came over to me, and she said, oh, so I was reading this stuff about gender and numbers, and Of course, it's obvious. I've always thought that. I've just never brought it up because I just assumed everyone else thought exactly the same thing. And I was like, well, this is fascinating. Why? And she said, well, that's obvious because odd numbers are a bit more spiky. They're a bit more male, whereas even numbers which can sort of divide, sort of split in two, which is almost like kind of giving birth. It's a very kind of feminine attribute. And this is someone who thought, you know, almost a super smart person, thought this was so common that she never bothered to bring it up because she thought it was obvious.
I'm really taken aback because just in the office when we were talking about your book, our senior producer, Maureen, she said the same thing. She said she's always given numbers sort of little identities, and it's never been something I've ever done. So it seems so alien to me.
Yes, I'm kind of with you in the sense that I've never had favorite numbers and I've never looked at numbers and thought, oh, that number is like such and such a person. But when I started to think about it, I definitely have different feelings towards odds and evens. I mean, there's another psychology experiment which also explains why we might see odds as different to evens. Imagine you're just shown two digits. Either both are odd, or both are even, or one is even and one is odd. So either say 2-4, that's both even, 3-5, that's both odd, or 2-3, even odd. All you're supposed to do when you're seen to see these two numbers is press a button if they're both the same, so when they're two even or two odd. It turns out that we're much faster at pressing the button when they're too even, and we're much slower when they're too odd, and also when both of them are odd, we make more mistakes. So there's this idea that actually it takes our brains longer to process odd numbers than even numbers. So it's not surprising that we invest it with more emotion.
Like they're literally harder to grasp.
Absolutely, and there's one way that actually the English language does us a disservice in understanding this, because we have two completely different words for odd and even, the word odd and the word even. They're not related at all. In all the other of the world's major languages, French, Russian, German, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, the word for odd is just not even. So you have even and not even numbers. So it's evenness precedes oddness as a psychological idea and as a way we process it.
Well, Alex, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Alex Billos is author of The Grapes of Math, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. There's much more on his book and a video Alex made detailing the correct way to slice a birthday cake. I promise you've been doing it wrong, mathematically speaking. All that's at wordofmouthradio.org. When we come back, we'll tackle a number that few people seem to agree on, how much to tip, and why our tipping habits have little to do with quality of service. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever worked in the service industry, you know firsthand tips can vary wildly. Michael Lynn, a professor at Cornell University's School of Hotel Management, has spent his career trying to figure out why. Turns out there are a lot of factors at play, often having nothing to do with the quality of service at all, everything from a server's posture and handwriting to the religious beliefs and alcohol consumption of the customer. Here's Freakonomics Radio's Stephen Dubner talking to Michael Lynn about the surprising results of his research on tipping behavior and why he thinks it's a failed system.
What about differences in tipping for black customers toward black versus white servers?
Both groups, blacks and whites, will tip a white server more than a black server. And that's even controlling for perceptions of service quality.
So a black customer will tip a black server less than a black customer will tip a white server.
Yes.
All else being equal.
Yes.
Wow. So it's fascinating. What can you tell us about other racial or ethnic groups, Asians, Latinos, immigrants versus, you know, on and on? I'll
sure.
take whatever you have. It's fascinating.
The data on other ethnic groups is more mixed. There are several studies finding that Hispanics tip less than whites, but there are studies showing no Hispanic-white difference in tipping. I haven't yet teased apart what's going on. Why am I getting it sometimes and not others? And the same thing is true with Asians. I do have some studies showing that Asians tip less than whites, other studies showing that they do not. The one thing I can say for certain is that the Asian-white difference, even when it does exist, is very fragile. That is, I can control for things like sex, education, income, and it disappears. The Hispanic-white, when it exists, is often robust. I can control for education, income, and it's still there. but I don't find it as consistently as I find the black-white difference.
With all groups, once you control for income, if you can, men versus women as customers, who tips more?
In general, there's no sex difference.
Is that right?
Yeah. And even the sex of server, sex of customer interaction that we talked about previously, it has been observed consistently enough for me to say it's a real effect, but it's not universal. You don't always find that effect either.
I see. What about the age of the customer?
Older customers tend to tip less. They're also more willing – they base their tips on service quality a little bit more than younger people.
Mm-hmm. So let me – you obviously know so much about this strange but common practice of tipping. If you could rewrite the custom, rewrite the social moray, which is obviously impossible because it arrives over a lot of time with a lot of people participating in it, what would you do? How would you make tipping more either sensible or directly related to the things it should be related to and so on?
You know, I think I would outlaw it.
You would.
Yeah. And it might be illegal as it is because of the race of server effect that we had previously discussed. It's you can make the argument that tipping is a condition of employment that has an adverse impact on a protected class.
So it's discriminatory.
It's discriminatory.
Saying.
And the Supreme Court has ruled that even neutral business practices that are not intended to discriminate, if they have the effect of adversely impacting a protected class, are illegal. And so it's not inconceivable to me that there will be a class action lawsuit on the part of ethnic minority waiters and waitresses claiming discrimination in terms of employment. And it's conceivable that tipping might be declared illegal on that basis.
You're talking theoretically or is this a movement that actually exists?
Oh, I know of no such lawsuit in existence, but mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. – I've talked to
– Not hard for you to imagine.
It's not hard for me to imagine. I've talked to lawyers including people who specialize in labor and employment law and I've gotten mixed opinions. I mean some of those lawyers have said, no, the courts would never go there. Others go, no, that is a reasonable theory of the law. That's plausible.
I think it is plausible. My firm would take a good hard look at a case if a server came to us and made that complaint.
Justin Swartz is a lawyer at Outen & Golden in New York City. He represents employees in class action discrimination cases. He's sued some of the biggest restaurants in New York for shorting employees on the tips they deserved. If his firm were to take on a discrimination case like Michael Lynn has proposed, Swartz would pursue two lines of argument.
First would be disparate impact analysis. The purpose of disparate impact analysis is to eliminate what the Supreme Court calls headwinds, policies that make it harder for racial minorities or other people in other protected classes to succeed.
With disparate impact, you don't have to prove that discrimination is intentional. It's a proxy for discrimination.
The idea is that if there's a disproportionate impact on a particular group, here it would be African-American or non-white servers, then the plaintiffs have made the first showing that they need to make in their case.
And the second argument?
The second step, then, is the employer's burden.
Meaning it's up to the employer to prove that tipping is a business necessity, not a custom, but a necessity. Let's say I'm a restaurateur and I come to you and I say, look, I know what you do. I know who you represent. And I want to avoid unfairness and I also want my business to prosper. So let's say I calculate the average tips in my restaurant and it's 20%. And I hate the fact that wait staff member A earns 50% more than wait staff worker Z because wait staff worker A happens to have these attributes that for whatever reason get a lot of tips. Pooling is complicated for whatever reason. Let's just say I don't want to deal with all that complication. So I'm just going to say on my menu to my clientele, we're getting rid of tipping because it's inefficient, sloppy, and potentially discriminatory. Average tips here were about 20%. And therefore, we're just going to ban tipping and instead raise our prices 20%.
I don't see any problem with that from a labor law perspective. And in fact, that might be the best way for restaurants to insulate themselves from liability.
Now, you may know that some restaurants in the U.S. have already eliminated tipping. They use an automatic service charge instead. If customers want to, they can tip on top of that service charge. One restaurant in San Diego, called The Linkery, has gone so far as to ban tipping. If you leave extra money on top of The Linkery's 18% service charge, that money will be given to charity. Jay Porter owns The Linkery. He thinks tipping is absolutely ridiculous.
If tipping had never been invented and you were starting a restaurant, would you use tipping as the way to compensate your best employees, your most important employees, all your employees? Would that be the system that you would pick in a vacuum to compensate your team? And I think the answer is clearly no, because it's a stupid system. So why not do it the right way, even if it's a little scary?
That story was brought to us by Freakonomics Radio. Up next, can smoothing wrinkles help make you happier? A closer look at the unusual practice of treating depression with Botox. That's coming up after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. It's best known for smoothing facial wrinkles, but Botox has many uses, treating migraines, vocal cord disorders, excessive sweating, and more recently, it's being used for depression. Freelance writer Taffy Brodesser-Ackner wrote about the treatment in an article for Pacific Standard and even tried it herself. Taffy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Of course. So off the bat, I guess we should clarify that Botox isn't going to interfere with brain chemistry the way that antidepressants do. So what's the idea here?
The idea is that it's actually your facial expressions that interfere with your brain chemistry, that an emotion is not what you think it is. It's a thought that you then manifest with your face, and the expression you make with your face actually seals in the emotion and turns it into a feeling. Before that, it's just a sort of impulse that would have passed had you not solidified it with your face. And that's called the facial feedback hypothesis. And I want to emphasize that it's a hypothesis. It has not been proven. It's just very, very widely believed.
So this is the idea, I guess, that, you know, if you fake it, you'll make it. So if I wasn't feeling very well, but I just made myself smile and I pretended I was happy, I might actually get happier.
That's true. Anyone with a passing familiarity with women's magazines knows that if you smile, you will feel happier. And people even who are tricked into smiling, meaning they're made to hold pencils in their mouths to simulate smiling, report feeling happier, even though they have pencils in their mouths.
So, I mean, I think I can relate to this idea that my expression feeds into my emotion and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But how would people who, say, suffered a stroke or something like that feel about this? I could imagine you might be a little offended to think that you feel less emotion because you can't express in the same way that others can.
Well, that's what the people who argue that this isn't true say. They talk about people with Mobius syndrome who are born with a partial facial paralysis, to which I say, I mean, is, you know, there's no control there. How do you know how depressed they would have been in the first place? But you actually don't hear reports of people with, say, Parkinson's disease having more depression other than situational depression from the Parkinson's disease.
Okay, so you found a doctor. His name is Eric Finzi, and
mm-hmm.
he's been experimenting with this facial feedback hypothesis with Botox.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about his studies and his findings?
So he first put out a call in his office for people who were depressed. He injected them with Botox, and what he found was astounding. He found people who had been sort of paralyzed by their lives, people who didn't socialize anymore. And he found that they felt better about themselves and they were going out into the world. And the instinct is to think that that you look better and so you feel better. And that is certainly some of the criticism here. However, that sort of criticism, when people make it, I feel like they don't really understand the nature of depression. Depression isn't just feeling ugly. Really deep depression is an inability to do anything.
Well, you admit in your article that you've suffered from depression yourself. So like any good journalist, you tried out the treatment.
Yes.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about your emotional state before the procedure, just to get a sense of the before and after you. What was your depression like?
Sure. I'm normally a very sort of emphatic person. I have a wide spectrum of emotion. I am really, really down when I'm down, and I'm really, really up when I'm up. Sort of all in the normal range. But when I'm depressed, and I had been for a little bit, my husband had lost his job. I was living in a place I didn't want to be, and that sort of all got to me, and I found myself sort of surrounded by the darkness that I've experienced in my life, maybe three or four times in my life, of deep, deep depressions. This was not a deep, deep depression, but it had the notes of it. I had been following Dr. Finzi's work for a long time because I always felt that there was something about how emphatic I am in my expression that is linked to my very wide spectrum of emotion. The people I know who feel more stable than I am in my life are people who are not as expressive. And my husband rarely makes facial expressions, and he is pretty much, you know, steady as she goes.
So what was it like? How did your face feel afterwards?
So, the truth is I really panicked. It's this slow feeling of paralysis. I don't know why people don't talk about that more. I was very surprised at the Botox experience. That suddenly part of your face, you can't move. It felt to me a little bit like being slowly buried alive. But then again, as I said, I'm prone toward drama.
Well, I was going to say that doesn't sound like it works very well then, because the idea is to make you feel better.
Again, that is to suppose that depression's a rational thing. Oh, I should feel better, or I should feel worse because I feel like I'm being buried alive. The experience made me feel incredibly flat. It made me feel as though the spectrum of my emotions had been shortened, meaning I wasn't very sad anymore. I wasn't very happy either. I just became this really sort of cool observer version of myself that I did not know even could exist.
I was really interested to hear about how much it affected your social interactions. I mean, you talk about people treating you differently and you not being able to react the same way to experiences that you would before.
What's really interesting about Botox is how it interrupts your empathy. We all have these things in our brains, these adaptive neurons called mirror neurons. And they exist so that when we're talking to somebody, we imitate their expression. And when we imitate their expression, that's our signal to them that we hear them, that we understand the emotion that they're trying to convey, right? If I were sitting there in the studio with you and I frowned, you would unconsciously frown without knowing that you were doing. I mean, that's what unconsciously means.
Right. I would just naturally mirror what you're doing. I understand we do the same thing with gestures and the way we position our bodies.
Right. We do all of that. And that is some really advanced circuitry that allows us to relate to each other. It allows us to feel together, which is something we absolutely need. And what happens when you mute the ability to mirror somebody's emotions is that not only do they feel less empathized with, but you feel less empathetic. You are no longer imitating their emotion. It was very, very startling to me, the amount of people who came to me over the course of this time and told me sad things or happy things. And I knew the right emotions to have. I didn't become a sociopath, right? I knew the emotions, oh, that's really terrible. Oh, I'm so happy for you. But all I could think the entire time was, I don't really care. I used to be somebody who would cry if you were crying. And then suddenly I just did not care.
So looking back, was it worth it?
It was worth it because, again, depression is a beast and saving yourself from it is worth it. Then again, when you are depressed, you need all the friends you can get. People really found me very strange, and it perhaps is because I am so emphatic normally. But, you know, like my children would cry, and I didn't care that much. I would see to them, but they must have somehow picked up that I wasn't that interested. And I wasn't that interested in anything. And that is also a symptom of depression. But this didn't hurt. This didn't bother me.
I guess I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of people that might have a stigma against taking antidepressants. And at the same time, there's another group of people who might have a stigma against having Botox as a treatment. And I'm wondering, for you, having experienced both, do you think it was more or less invasive emotionally and physically than it would be to take drugs?
That's a great question. I think that I live in Los Angeles, where people will only eat organic food, and they have special oxygen machines, and yet they pump poison into their faces. I think both of them are chemicals. I think both of them, the jury is still out, but it was very much the same experience for me. I often describe having taken antidepressants as you're inside and your emotions are outside a window tapping, muffled, trying to get in. And you know what they are, but you can't really feel them. This was very much the same thing for me.
Well, Taffy, thank you so much for sharing this experience with us. It's really fascinating.
Thank you so much, Taylor. It's been a pleasure.
Taffy Brodesser-Ackner is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Playboy, and the Wall Street Journal. We found her article, How Botox Can Solve the Depression Epidemic, in Pacific Standard Magazine. In Afghanistan, some men and women meet for the first time at the marriage altar. And if a groom pulls back the veil and does not like what he sees, he can actually send the woman back, shamed and tainted, to her family. The practice has led an increasing number of Afghan women to consider plastic surgery. Reporter Greg Warner followed one such woman into the surgeon's office to investigate.
Since she was 12, Benafsha was sure that if not for the shape of her nose, she'd be beautiful.
Mostly it was my sister that would mention it. When we got in an argument, she'd say, "Your nose is like the fist of a cat."
Benafsha is Hazara, the Asian-featured ethnic minority. In Afghanistan, the beauty standard is Persian or Indian. Straight noses are preferred.
Girls have to be beautiful for marriage. They can't have noses that are too flat.
As an Afghan woman, making a good marriage was pretty much her only option for having a decent life. When mothers of prospective suitors came to visit, they always scrutinized her nose. So the winter she turned 19, Benafsha collected $60 she'd saved, plus another $200 from her uncle, and took it all to a crumbling building in downtown Kabul, to a clinic smelling faintly of formaldehyde.
This is the new operation room?
Yes.
Dr. Hamkar is the lead surgeon of Afghanistan's first and only plastic surgery clinic.
It's very primitive.
It is very primitive.
Primitive operation. The lamp is not...
A big green lamp from the Soviet era illuminates the operating table, while a row of kitchen cabinets are jammed with gauze and scalpels. The TV stuck in the corner plays that most psychedelic of American cartoon shows, Teletubbies.
This is something new.
That's Hamkar's assistant, Dr. Daoud.
In Afghanistan, especially recently, this year, we see some patients who come to have, for example, for mammoplasty.
That means breast?
Breast, yeah, to have a smaller breast.
Daoud blames Afghan television. Afghans went from no TV under the Taliban to a flood of movies and even fashion and style shows today.
It made the people to care about their physical condition, about, They said that I'll show you a picture of, for example, actress, Indian actress. They say, I want to look like this. But they think that it's possible to change their face at all.
They want a whole new face?
Yeah, because of some movies, I think, they've watched on TV, for example, American or Indian movies. They think that it's possible.
But Daoud says that most of the clients in his clinic don't come pursuing a fantasy. They just want a normal life.
For example, girls who have some problem on their face, and this is the reason why they cannot get married. There was a girl, she had some hairs, you know, on her face. And she was engaged. Her fiancé didn't know about the beard that girl had, you know.
Her future husband had only ever seen her in a burqa.
She said if he knows about it, she'll be divorced and it will be something very bad for her.
So she hawked her engagement ring, paid Daoud for the treatment, and by the time the burqa came off on her wedding day...
When her husband lifted off her veil for the first time and he looked at her face... Do you think he could tell that she had had surgery, or he?
No.
You think he just thought, this is my beautiful
I
wife?
I think so. Yeah.
یا مثل که خواستگارم یا مدن یک بینی ازی خراب است.
It's afternoon when Benaf Shah, the first girl we met, comes in for her checkup. She's wearing a colored headscarf and pink nail polish and proudly sports a cardboard cast over her nose. It's been 9 days since her nose job.
Actually, can you do me a favor? Can we look at the photo together? Is it okay?
I asked Daoud to call up the before photo on the computer, the original nose that her sister called a cat's fist. And as they do it, I can't help but notice that Benaf Shah blushes. When the doctors do show her the photo of her old nose, you can hear her voice is diminished, like she's lost her confidence. There's that old debate about cosmetic surgery. Is it a form of self-expression, or is it social pressure? Of course, it's both. We get the freedom to change ourselves, and we use it to look like everybody else. In Afghanistan, too, they're mixed together. The freedom to uncover and the freedom to conceal.
That story was produced by BendingBorders.org as part of the Global Story Project with support from the Open Society Foundations and presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Baby Mozart, Baby Beethoven, Baby Bach. From 1997 to 2000, the Baby Einstein Empire put out a series of videos aimed at stimulating children's brains through classical music. And around that time, there were also countless articles and books based off this idea that classical music boosts intelligence in children. The boom can actually be traced back to one rather modest scientific study published in 1993. So, does listening to Mozart make kids smarter? Pitchfork contributor Jason Green has his doubts, and he's here on the show to share them with us. Jason, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about this original study that supposedly established the quote-unquote Mozart effect.
Well, it was a study done for a journal called Nature, and the initial study was actually rather modest. A group of college students, basically, were given 10 minutes of Mozart or so to listen to. And the control group were given silence or soothing relaxation, like instructions to listen to. And then they were graded on spatial reasoning questions. And for about a little while, a short period after listening to Mozart, there was a modest observable spike. So basically, that is the very modest origin of what became a massive, massive commercial empire eventually. And that was sort of what I grew interested in exploring for this piece I wrote.
Yeah, so this original study, not done on children, results were temporary, not permanent. So why do you think this Mozart effect was first associated with a child's brain development?
Well, you can trace some of it back to a book that got published in 1997 by a music critic and entrepreneur named Don Campbell that kind of coined the term Mozart effect and associated with children. And this was the seed for what kind of became this massive industry. There's this ball that got set rolling in people's minds, and I think it got sort of reached out to and latched onto and pulled into this ongoing war people have with their anxieties over making sure that their children have everything that they should have to be as developed as they can be.
Right, right. So it has more to do with the psychology of a parent who just desperately wants something that's going to make their kids succeed than it does with actually changing a child's brain.
Absolutely. I mean, what I thought was really interesting was how little studies that measured recorded music upon the brain really have shown us much of anything conclusive yet. There have been so many articles and studies about what happens to people after they listen to this type of music, what happens when they listen to this type of music. And some of that, of course, is related to so-called violent or antisocial music like heavy metal and rap. There have been an unfortunate number of studies devoted to sort of trying to establish a link between violent behavior and listening to records of, that feature graphic imagery or I have violent lyrics. And those have also been very widely inconclusive and have pretty much failed to establish any link whatsoever. When it comes to what actually happens inside your brain when you're listening to recorded music, people really don't know. If you're talking about something much more concrete, like holding an instrument in your hands and playing the instrument and learning the relationship between notes with your fingers, there's actually been a lot of research that talks about how that is tremendously beneficial for you. But records are this fascinating thing. I'm a music critic, and I listen to records all the time. And, of course, there's a very easy leap between I'm spending all my time doing this to what is this doing for me? And I think that was maybe the genesis of this exploration, because I think a lot of people wonder that with music. What is this doing for me?
Speaking of which, you're the father of a, 14-month-old?
Yes, about to be 15 months. Yes.
Okay, so you know, do you find yourself playing classical music just, I guess, to cover the bases?
Of course. Of course. You know, when I had my phone playing music and it went from something that I intended to play, like a Paul McCartney song or something really light and happy and emotional, to something very loud and dark, I fairly lunged for my phone, you know, to turn it off. And it wasn't like I thought that was the wrong thing to do or that was silly, but it definitely got me thinking about these questions, and it made me think about my own childhood. I wrote a little bit about that in the piece, about all the incredibly toxic stuff that I recall just gobbling up happily, tapes of, you know, Slayer and Megadeth and Ice-T, and I seem to not have ended up a warped sociopath. But I definitely, it made me appreciate some of those hard decisions that people make. It made me think about it for the first time when, you know, you have this developing brain in front of you. And especially as a first parent, this isn't my second child, this is my first child. And so everything is this terrifying new, you know, vista of mystery. You have no idea what you're doing. And the only certainty you have is that you'll find out what you did wrong years later. So I think right. That every decision becomes charged with that sort of, what should I do?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you know, as I was thinking about the Mozart effect, which I did the same thing. I have a 3-year-old son, and when he was maybe between 6 months and 1.5, you know, I would do the same thing. I would put on classical music stations on Pandora or Spotify if I was just cooking dinner.
Sure.
The more I think about it, though, it almost makes me uncomfortable. There's this sense that here we are thinking that this, you know, very white European genre of music is going to make your child smarter. But why not jazz? Why not prog rock? What would it be about classical music especially that could have an effect that other music can't?
Well, and that's really a powerful question that I also tried to think about a little bit, because I write about hip-hop quite often as well as classical. I kind of occupy a strange niche, and I choose to write about both and engage with both. I grew up listening to a lot of hardcore rap, and I took violin lessons my whole life. So both of those musics were in my life. And I absolutely think that there is a very odd and unsettling racial coding coursing beneath some of these ideas about how classical music is somehow good for you, where, as you mentioned, jazz or some other kind of form of music is like not as good for you. It has a lot of really troubling assertions sort of embedded inside of it. If there's a music that I feel challenges my intellect more fiercely on a more day-to-day basis, it's hip-hop, without question.
Okay, so given all these things we're both thinking about, what's on your baby playlist nowadays?
Well, so the rap, actually, I have been trying, and I do think that the emotional content of the music is important, and the sound. Babies react to sounds of voices, right?
Sure,
and
sure,
so,
yeah.
No one wants to be yelled at, you know, so I don't put on Ice Cube, but I do put on De La Soul and Tribe. The voices tend to be a lot softer. The beats tend to be a little more mellifluous and melodic and less skeletal and harsh. I do look forward to the moment in whatever stage of my child's development I deem it appropriate to first play her Ice Cube, but it's definitely a ways away. I listen to music that matters a lot to me because that's what my parents did, stuff that has personal meaning. I play her a lot of Neil Young and John Prine because both of those artists meant a lot to my wife and to myself. I play her the Debussy String Quartet because I rehearsed it one summer years and years ago and became obsessed with it. And so I'm sharing that with her as a way of saying, here, to a 15-month-old, here, this is something that I care about. It's much more important to me to communicate that sense, this sort of relationship to music, than the playlist or the catalog itself. I'm not going through a mental checklist of has my baby heard Ornette Coleman yet, in necessarily, so much as it is, these are the records and the pieces of music that have helped me through my life and made me who I am.
Jason Green is the managing editor of Wondering Sound and a contributor to Pitchfork. Jason, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find a link to his article, Mozart Makes You Smarter and Other Dubious Musical Theories, and check out his Spotify baby playlist at wordofmouthradio.org. While you're there, send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.